gravity. But in fact, I will not only speak about superficial gravity, but about a canonical formalism, which is much more general. I will try to give you a broad overview of this canonical formalism. However, in some cases, I actually need to use some technical results that we will do in the second part of the talk. And in some cases here and there, we'll apply this then to edge calculus. So this is actually work that has been done in collaboration with Bianca Dietrich. Here are some of the references. But some of the results I will present are also unpublished yet. So here's the plan of the talk. I will first of all start with giving a motivation for why it would be interesting to consider a canonical formulation of discrete dynamics. Then afterwards, I will tell you something about some of the options that we have for discrete evolution schemes in superficial gravity. Then in the third part of the talk, I will then introduce the general canonical formalism for discrete systems. There I will also present some of the technical results. And then after that, I want to discuss the constraints and symmetries that necessarily arise in this framework, and then finally want to conclude and mention some of the open challenges. So I thought I'd start with a brief recap of Regge calculus, because possibly not everyone is familiar with it. We don't need many details of Regge calculus, just a few basic properties, and let me just review them here. So the basic idea of Regge calculus is that we replace the smooth d-dimensional space-time by some piecewise linear flat metric living on some triangulation, which is comprised of d-dimensional simplices. So now when we have this triangulation, we have to think about how one can describe the geometry of it. In the continuum, we do that, of course, by the metric. Here we now have a piecewise linear flat metric. And it turns out that in the triangulations, you can describe the entire geometry of it once you know all the length of all the edges in the triangulation. So the length of the edges are the configuration variables in the Regge calculus, therefore. And so they really encode the complete geometry. So this is one thing that we will make use of here. And the other thing is a property of the action. So first of all, the Regge action is a discretization of the Einstein-Hilbert action. At this stage, I should say I'm, for simplicity, only going to work in Euclidean signature in the rest of this talk. But so yeah, the Regge action is given as a discretization of this Einstein-Hilbert action, and it's given by two terms, a bulk term and a boundary term. So the task is basically to translate the curvature term, the Ricci scalar, into the discrete. The way this is done in the Regge calculus is to measure basically a curvature by so-called deficit angles, epsilon here. What they do is they measure the deviation from 2 pi of the sum of dihedral angles around so-called hinges in the triangulation. Hinges are d minus two-dimensional subsimplices. So in 3 dimensions, these are the edges, and in 4 dimensions, the triangles. And these hinges are basically the carriers of curvature in the triangulation. So the curvature only has support on the hinges, and that's also why the deficit angle here is only multiplied by the volume of the hinge. So this roughly explains how this action comes about. And then, in fact, the boundary term is very similar to the bulk term, with the sole difference that now instead of a deficit angle, we're dealing with so-called extrinsic curvature angles, and they measure the deviation from pi around in the dihedral angles around the hinges in the boundary. So one nice feature of this action in this form is that, in fact, it is additive. And it's additive in the sense that when you glue two pieces of triangulation together, then the action contribution of the entire piece of triangulation is just given by the sum of the individual parts. So, and this is one thing that we will actually be making use of later on. So now this is all that we need from Regge calculus in this talk. So now let's go to the main part of the motivation. And let me state the goal of this talk straight away. So the goal is that we want to have a time evolution for triangulations, and we want to put that into a canonical language. And furthermore, another requirement that we want to satisfy is that we want this canonical formalism to be equivalent to the covariant formalism in the sense that we solve the solutions following from the action at each of the steps, so that we really get the dynamics. And also, just as in the continuum canonical theory, we also want to describe this theory in terms of hypersurfaces that evolve through our d-dimensional solution. And one challenge that we immediately face when we want to do that is what I shall call the problem of foliations, and that is a generic triangulation will be such that hypersurfaces at different steps will be comprised of different numbers of simplices, and the simplices that carry the variables of the theory in the Regge calculus, the the length of the edges are the configuration variables. That means at different steps, we will have different numbers of variables. So in general, we actually need a mapping between phase spaces of different dimensions. So this is one challenge that we have to face. And so this is what we want to do in this talk here. So we want to consider the general situation where we can allow for the spatial lattice to evolve and change in the course of evolution. So, and this is also partially motivated, for example, by loop quantum gravity, where also spatial graphs can evolve throughout evolution, particularly if we think of spin forms. So, and yeah, one thing that we have to deal with then is that the numbers of degrees of freedom may vary. Okay, so this is the goal. So here we may then ask, why would one bother to consider such a general construction at all? There's a few reasons why it may be a promising endeavor. So classically, we want to understand the discrete dynamics in a better way and also geometrically in a better geometric fashion. And furthermore, we also want to capture the full space of discrete solutions, so not just restrict to some special triangulations which are preserved in the course of evolution. So, and then furthermore, it may also be, in fact, advantageous for several physical situations to be able to treat growing or shrinking lattice, for example, if you want to model an expanding or contracting universe, and also if you want to implement that on a computer. In fact, what we'll see in this talk is that some of the evolution processes that we can model in the canonical language, they just involve some updating procedures, which in particular should be amenable to numerical implementations. So, but then also for quantum gravity, some of the motivation, actually it's twofold. On the one hand, we want to see if we can understand better the links between the covariant and canonical approaches that exist in quantum gravity. In particular, it would be nice, of course, to understand the link between loop quantum gravity and spin forms better. So, but what we will do here in this talk is, at least for logic calculus, we get classically a formalism which is where the canonical formalism is equivalent to the covariant one, and this presumably will also hold in the quantum theory. So, and then another motivation is also that just as we want to understand the dynamics better in the classical setting, we would also, of course, eventually like to understand the Hamiltonian dynamics, at least in the regularized theory, also in the quantum theory. And then subsequent question may be then whether, after all, ultimately, really time evolution in quantum gravity is continuous or also generated by some discrete evolution moves. But so in this talk, I will mainly focus on the classical part here. So okay, the motivation is therefore dynamics and equivalence of covariant and canonical picture. So okay, so the requirement is, as I just said, that we want the covariant and the canonical formalism to be equivalent. The one thing that it immediately implies is that that we need, or that the time evolution, in fact, will be discrete. So because at the end of the day, we want to have a full triangulation. And in fact, discrete evolution cannot be generated by any set of constraints. So here, the evolution will, in fact, be generated by some set of evolution moves. And I will mention shortly what set of evolution moves I mean here. So there are some similarities and differences between the continuum and the discrete, which I shall mention here. So in the canonical theory, in the continuum, we restrict to space-times which are globally hyperbolic at the outset, which is of a product topology type where sigma is some three-manifold, of course. And it turns, as we will see later on in this talk, we will do the same here in the discrete. We will also get some triangulation, which is also of a product topology type where sigma, again, is some triangulated three-manifold, and we will come to that later on. So now in the continuum, we have the, in canonical general relativity, the hypersurface deformation algebra. And in fact, these constraints, they satisfy several roles. The first one is, of course, that they generate time evolution. Second role is that they also ensure that we get the correct dynamics. So because they put constraints on the data at each of the steps, so they guarantee us that we get the correct solutions to the Einstein equations. And furthermore, they also generate symmetries. So, and now in the discrete, the situation is a little different. Here, the role of the constraints is only twofold. So A, they do not generate the time evolution, as I just said. So the time evolution will be generated by some evolution moves. And rather, but they actually do ensure also here that we get the correct dynamics. So we also get constraints here, and constraints will actually implement the equations of motion. And in that sense, when we implement them, guarantee that we get the correct dynamics. And furthermore, also as in the continuum, they can generate symmetries, but in fact, the situation is a little more subtle than the continuum. But these two points, B and C, are what I will discuss in more detail at the end of the talk. So, and then in the continuum, it turns out that the evolution is hyperbolic. I mean, that just has to do with the fact that we're dealing with a globally hyperbolic space-time. And in fact, the three manifold here is a Cauchy slice. And this, however, does not necessarily need to hold in the discrete, need not be hyperbolic, but that's also not a big surprise because many discrete systems are not hyperbolic. So in fact, what we will get in this talk, we can actually also interpret as an algorithm to generate d-dimensional solutions, for example, in the Regge calculus. And the steps basically can be broadly summarized into the following four steps here. First of all, we have to choose some canonical initial data on some d minus one triangulated hypersurface. Then we have to choose some set of evolution moves. I will come to that in a minute. And then once we have these evolution moves, we have to choose a sequence of these evolution moves. And then we have to perform them. And then the fourth task is that we have to make sure that these constraints that arise in this framework are always satisfied. In fact, they implement the equations of motion. And then this fourth step is therefore really the most non-trivial part of this algorithm, if you like. So, and if at any stage we run up against the situation where any of the constraints is not satisfied, then that just simply means that we have to perform a different move. So. The claim is that at the end, the end result of this is then a d-dimensional Regge solution. So I hope this will become clear in the rest of this talk. So, okay, now let me discuss a little more the different choices that we have for the evolution moves and the sequences. I mean, a priori, we have broadly two choices. First of all, we can simply restrict the evolution moves to a very particular set, and we can also fix the sequences of these evolution moves at the outset so that we restrict only to a subspace of the solutions arising from the initial data. If you want to make things simple, I will give an example on the next slide of this, but we can also consider the general situation where we do not restrict the sequences at all, and we try to find a set of evolution moves which are as general as possible in the sense that we can really generate all triangulations arising from a given set of initial data. So we really want to allow for the full freedom in the evolutions. And in fact, this choice two is basically what the main focus of this talk will be on. So for example, if we now choose option one, one particular kind of evolution moves that we have in triangulations is, for example, the so-called tent moves. What one does in these tent moves is basically one picks some triangulated hypersurface. Here's a two-dimensional example. So we can pick some vertex in this triangulated hypersurface, say this one here. Then one erects what one calls a tent pole on this vertex. And then the new vertex at the other end of this tent pole will just be connected to the neighboring vertices of the original vertex in such a way that the spatial triangulation, I mean, the connectivity is preserved. I mean, the geometry may change, but the connectivity of the spatial triangulations is preserved. And if one does that at each of the vertices only to perform tent moves, then well, it turns out that if one translates that in a canonical language, then we just get a standard phase space picture where everything is preserved as we know it. So I haven't really talked much about the phase space picture, but I will do that now in the sequel. And I just wanted to give you an example of one of the restrictive moves. So now if we want to consider the more general situation, so now we want to allow for generating all types of triangulation that arise from a given set of initial data. The basic idea is then in order to achieve this is that we basically glue a single d-dimensional simplex to a d minus one dimensional triangulated hypersurface at each of the steps that we count by n. And we do that in such a way that this hypersurface evolves in a discrete multi-finger time through our full d-dimensional solution. And that's an analogy to canonical general relativity, where also the hypersurfaces evolve in a continuous multi-finger time through the full d-dimensional solution. So now if we want to implement that in a canonical language, it turns out that actually this requires the action to be additive. So in the very beginning, I mentioned that in the Regge calculus, the action is additive. And that's also why when we apply this to superficial gravity, we apply it in particular to Gradient calculus. Okay, so this is basically the d-dimensional picture of generating an arbitrary triangulation, basically. But in fact, these gluing moves of gluing single simplices to a triangulation also has a very nice interpretation within the d-1 triangulated hypersurfaces. So here's an example in three dimensions where we glue a single tetrahedron onto a single triangle. In three dimensions, it just looks like this. But then if we look at it from a two-dimensional perspective, then it will look like this. So this triangle here basically gets subdivided into three new ones at step n plus one, where this new vertex here just corresponds to the tip of the tetrahedron that we have glued to this hypersurface. And this is what is called the 1-3 Pachner move. So there's particular number of Pachner moves in any dimensions, and you can get all these Pachner moves by similar gluing moves. Now, the nice feature about Pachner moves is that, first of all, they are actually elementary. They're elementary in the sense that each of these Pachner moves involves a very fixed number of simplices. So it's actually a very local class of moves. And furthermore, they are ergodic and topology preserving in the sense that you can map between any two triangulations of a fixed topology by finite sequences of these moves, if we consider finite triangulations. So these are really a general class of moves that can generate all kinds of triangulations. And these would then be the set of most elementary and general evolution moves. So, and because they actually preserve the topology, in this case, they preserve the spatial topology. That's why then also why the topology of the resulting four-dimensional or d-dimensional triangulation will be of a product type, I times sigma, where I is some interval, and sigma is just the topology of the triangulated hypersurface. And that's just like in general relativity. So here is now an illustration of how this evolution can look like in a two-dimensional hypersurface. So I mean, in fact, these Pachner moves are, I mean, because they're general, they can reproduce all kinds of evolution moves that you can imagine in triangulation. So they can also reproduce tent moves. And for example, here we now have a five-valent vertex, and we can reproduce a tent move by performing a sequence of Pachner moves. So we introduce a 1-3 move, introduces a new vertex, and this here would then be the tent pole. Then we could perform a number of flip moves, and in the end, we move we remove one of the vertices, and then we're left again with a five-valent vertex. So in that sense, we kind of can interpret the sequence of Pachner moves as a tent move. So okay, so these are the evolution moves that we want to consider. And now the main question is, how can one implement such evolution moves in a canonical language? And this shall be now the main topic of the coming slides. So at this stage, I will be fairly general here because the canonical formalism that I will describe now is much more general than just for simplicial gravity. And later on, I will then apply it in particular to Gradient calculus and explain some of the repercussions of it. So the basic idea, basic ingredient that we want to use is, in fact, Hamilton's principal function. And Hamilton's principal function is just the action evaluated on solutions as a function of the initial and final data. And this, in fact, is a generating function for canonical time evolution in general. So, and this is what we will really want to make use of. So, and in fact, in the sequel, we will now assume that the action that we're dealing with is additive in the sense that when you have two regions, let's call them A and B, and you look at the combination of these two regions, then the action contribution of that should just be given by the sum of the individual contributions. So this is just like it happens in the Gradient calculus, as I mentioned in the very beginning. And then it turns out that if you want to know the Hamilton's principal function on the combination of these two regions, or the, then that is just given by basically taking the sum of the Hamilton's principal functions of these two regions and integrating out any variables that have become internal by gluing these two regions together. So this is what we will be making use of in the coming slides. Okay, so now let's assume we have a... Oh yeah, sorry. By this, I just mean that we extremize that So I'm just solving the equation of motion, basically. Yeah, sorry. So, okay, now let's assume we have a very general discrete system, which is described by this action here, which is given by the sum over action contributions from different steps, which where we label the steps by n. And now this action contribution at each step is a function on the direct product of configuration manifolds and maps that into the reals. And so this is a difference really between the discrete and the continuum, because in the continuum, the Lagrangian, in fact, is a function on the tangent bundle, where the tangent bundle is coordinatized by Q and Q dot. So here in the discrete, the role of the tangent bundle is taken over by this direct product of configuration manifolds, and the role of Q and Q dot is just taken over by xn minus 1 and xn. So, and
So just to bring it back to the calculation of macromodes. So you claim that the action is can be broken down into a series of a sum of actions for each step.
Yeah.
Okay. You're going to demonstrate that?
Well, I mean, it's actually not very difficult to convince oneself that this is true. I mean, one has to write it out a bit more, but I mean, it's just basically is a consequence of the Regen action given by the boundary terms. So, I mean, the difference between the bulk and boundary term is really the is that in the boundary term we measure the extrinsic curvature angle and not the deficit angles. So we measure the deviation from pi instead of 2 pi. But when you glue two pieces of triangulation together, two boundary pieces, make it into a bulk, then this becomes basically a deficit angle, and then
right. So with the boundary term, the Regen action is additive.
Yes.
And then you can identify each force simplex as the result of a Parkman mover as.
If you glue them, that's true. I mean, if you glue each force simplex step by step onto the triangulation, then each of these gluing moves you can interpret as a Parkman move in the hypersurface.
And then in each Parkman move, there's an initial set of edges and a final set of edges. So you use that structure.
Yeah, I mean, I will come to that actually.
Qn
in the
minus 1 Qn.
For example, yes. So I mean, this here at the moment, I'm just considering very general classes of system. But eventually, if you do that for ledger calculus, then that would be that some of the old edges are in this configuration manifold, and the new ones would be in that one right here. So I hope that will become a little clearer when I apply that.
What about edges that are common to the old?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, those we only count once. So maybe I explain that later on, because then at some stage we have to identify the configuration variables at different steps, but that will become clearer later on. So when I talk about the Parkman moves later on, I hope that will become clearer.
Yeah. So for the moment, it's just a general schema for discrete evolution.
Yeah. So at the moment, it's just any, it can be any discrete system. In fact, this is just variational discrete mechanics, what we're doing. So, but Regen calculus falls into that category. I mean, by variational, I mean that the configuration manifolds are continuous. And also in Regen calculus, the length of the edges can take continuous values. So in that sense, but we have discrete numbers of variables, of course. But individual variables can be continuous. And so in that sense, it's variational. And just for any such systems with additive action, what I will tell you here, this will hold for any such system. And the Regen calculus is one particular example of it. So now the point is really that in the discrete, this product of configuration manifolds takes over the role of a TQ, as I said, and the xn minus 1 and xn are just the coordinates by q and q dot. So, but I'm suppressing any further indices here than the axis, but the axis can represent any sets of data. Okay, so now we want to make use of these action contributions at each of these steps as a generating function of first kind, so it depends on old and new configuration variables. And if we differentiate this generating function with respect to the old and new configuration variables, then we get the momenta. So that's why we actually get two kinds of momenta here, and we shall call them the pre and the post momenta. So in fact, these pre and post momenta, they define us implicitly a time evolution map. For example, if we look at this equation right here, then in principle, we should be able to solve this equation for xn as a function of the data at step n minus 1. And then we can insert this in this equation, and in this way, we get the canonical data at step n. Okay, so here, so far we have defined the pre and post momenta by means of the action contribution from step n minus 1 to n. But of course, we could equally well use the action contribution between step n and n plus 1 as a generating function to define the momenta, and that's also what we do here then. So then we can also define the pre-momenta at step n. So now we have two types of momenta at step n. We have the pre-momenta and the post-momenta. But then when we impose the equations of motion here for variables at step n, then if you compare these equations of motion with the pre-momenta and the post-momenta here, then you see immediately that they're equivalent to a momentum matching. That means the pre and post-momenta are actually equivalent, identical on solutions. Okay, so let me tell you a little more about the phase spaces here. So let's recall, first of all, that in the continuum, the Legendre transformation maps us from the tangent bundle to the cotangent bundle in coordinates, goes from Q, Q dot to Q and P, where P is just given by this derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities. And this is now very similar also in the discrete setting, just with the difference that now we actually have two kinds of Legendre transformations, which we call the pre and the post Legendre transformations. And so we get two basically because now the role of the tangent bundle is taken over by the direct product of configuration manifolds. And that allows us now to map to the phase space at step n and to the phase space at step n minus 1. And in fact, the momenta are then just given by the pre and post momenta as I've introduced them on the previous slide. So this is really the difference between the discrete and the continuum, that now we actually have two kinds of Legendre transformations. Let me skip this maybe. So the reason I mentioned the Legendre transformations is because of constraints. So in the continuum, we actually get constraints. Of course, when the Legendre transformation is not an isomorphism, then it only maps to a subspace of the phase space, which is then the constraint surface, so we get constraints. And this is the case if this matrix here of second derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities is degenerate. So now, in fact, in the discrete, again, the situation is very similar, just with the difference that we have now two Legendre transformations. And these pre and post Legendre transformations, they simultaneously fail to be isomorphisms when this condition holds here, so the this matrix here is degenerate. So, and this, in fact, is, this matrix here is just the coordinate form of the Lagrangian 2 form. So, okay, if that's the case, then again, the Legendre transformation only maps on subspaces of the phase space, and so in this case, we actually get two constraint surfaces. So we call the image of the post Legendre transformation into the phase space at step n the post constraint surface, and the image of the Legendre transformation, of the pre-Legendre transformation into the phase space at step n minus 1, we call the pre-constraint surface. So this is really the difference, again, between the discrete and the continuum, that now we have two kinds of constraint surfaces. And now it turns out that essentially because this matrix has as many left as right null vectors, that the dimension of these pre and post constraint surfaces is identical. So, and the reason I mention all this here is actually because all this will feature prominently in the Regge calculus. In fact, it turns out that these post constraints are automatically satisfied by the past region. The pre constraints are automatically satisfied by the future region at a given step. But the non-trivial part is that the pre constraints impose non-trivial conditions on the past region, and the post constraints impose non-trivial conditions on the future region. And the non-trivial part is that we have to satisfy both the post and pre-constraints. And this is something.
So can you just remind the post or which one? The one
on the top? Or? Yeah, I mean, the one basically to when you have a given piece of triangulation, then the one to the future, basically. So the forwards. Yes, but not automatically by the future triangulation.
Are you going to impose both?
Yeah, you have to impose in the end. I mean, that's the non-trivial part that you have to satisfy. Both types
the
of constraints. I will come to that later on. So I mean, this is non-trivial part. So okay, so diagrammatically, the situation looks something like this here. So basically, we have the configuration manifolds, the direct product of them. We can map to the direct product of them at different time steps by Lagrangian time evolution, which I haven't really discussed here, but that just requires basically solving the equations of motion directly following from the action. But what I mentioned here is that from each of these products of configuration manifolds, you map directly by the pre and the post Legendre transformations to the constraint surfaces, the pre and post constraint surfaces in the respective phase spaces. And then really the non-trivial part is that we have to live on the intersection of these pre and post constraint surfaces, which need not be identical. So, but this is something that I want to discuss later on. So, okay, now I've told you somewhat more generally about this canonical formalism. Now let's come back to the evolution schemes in the Regge calculus. If we want to implement them in a canonical language, we a priori face three troubles here. The first one is that an evolution step, in fact, may involve bulk variables, for example, the tent moves. Here we have the tent pole, it's a bulk variable, so we have to take care of that. We have to integrate that out in the evolution step.
What do you mean by a bulk variable?
I mean, bulk, for example, I mean, it's internal in that, evolution step. Yeah. So it's basically, we have to solve its equation of motion. So, and then another problem is that hypersurfaces at different time steps, like here and here, may overlap, so that we have subsets of edges that overlap at different time steps, which in particular in Regge calculus means that we have subsets of, coinciding subsets of variables at the different steps. So, and then the last problem is also that. Sorry?
The fact that it involves
both
variables.
Yeah, yeah, so I mean, not for the Pachman moves. But I'm, because here I want to consider quite generally different evolution moves that we can consider. So, yeah, and the third problem is basically the problem of foliations that that I mentioned at the beginning. For example, here in the 1-3 Pachman move, after the move, we have three more edges than before, so it means the phase space will be larger after the move. So, in general, we have to deal with phase spaces of different dimensions.
So, by
what? Oh, yeah. This one here, you mean? Well, for example, in this case here, the in this 1-3 Pachner move, all the edges in these two hypersurfaces coincide except these three new ones. So, and that means that the configuration variables, the length variables associated to these edges, they will appear in both the steps before and after the move. So, we have to be able to deal with that also in a formulation. Okay, so I will just summarize you how one can deal with that in the canonical formalism. So first of all, in the problem with bulk variables, it's actually not really a problem. So let's just consider the situation where we have an action contribution which involves some bulk variables. So it has boundary variables here, which, for example, the Regge calculus could live in the boundaries, hypersurfaces of some fat slice. And then all the internal edges in between there would be labeled by this xi here.
So is there
which
notation here, the
ei and prime? Yeah, so I mean, these here would be the length variables in the boundaries here. In the this one here would be the length in the hypersurface sigma n. These ones here in the.
So what would e and I
reference to? E would just count over the numbers of edges that we have in that hypersurface.
Where is it from e and prime?
Sorry, I just wanted to denote the indices differently because I mean
edges.
What
do they refer to?
The E's, what they refer to?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. The
which one?
Yeah. So I mean the E's, they label the edges in the, for example, in the triangulated hypersurface.
No, but do they refer to different?
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean the E's here, the X E N, they refer to the edges in the hypersurface sigma n. So the E's run over all the edges that we have in that hypersurface.
The I n.
And the I just labels all edges internal at this step. Yeah, that's basically it. So
and E prime?
Yeah, E prime would just label the edges in sigma n minus 1 here. I mean, I've just put a prime on it to distinguish the, the indices at the different times.
So
yeah, okay, so but now we can use this again as a generating function of first kind. So we can again get the pre and post momenta just as we did it before. With the difference now that we actually get immediately some constraints here. For example, this constraint here arises. So I mean the momenta have to vanish of the internal variables of step n minus 1, which would kind of come before this slice right here, because the action just doesn't depend on these variables at that step. And this is relevant because also the momentum matching will hold for these bulk variables, and in particular, what so the pre and post momenta of these bulk variables have to be identical, and that just means, for example, that they will also impose the equations of motion here. So if you look at these post momenta of the bulk variables, these are just the equations of motion of the internal variables, and this, of course, has to be zero. And so this translates into the constraint that the momenta of internal variables have to vanish. So these are constraints which are equations of motion. And in fact, so for any evolution step, all the variables that have not yet occurred at this step, they will come with a vanishing momentum, and all those variables that have already gone into the past will also come with a vanishing momentum. So, and this is something that I will also make use of shortly. And now let's see how we can solve problem B. That's the problem of having coinciding subsets of variables at the different steps. So for example, if we perform a Pachner move, so we have some edges here in a given hypersurface, and then after the Pachner move, these edges are still in the hypersurface. So the question is then, how can one deal with that? So here we can actually make use of the additivity of the action again. So the action is just like we add a new piece of to it. And then if we derive the momenta, for example, the pre or post momenta, then the new relation would look like this, where this part here is just given by the old momentum. And so what happens really is that the momenta just get updated. So at step n plus 1, they're given by those at step n plus some new contribution. So and for the Pachner moves, what we then do is basically, for all those edges that occur in both hypersurfaces before and after the move, we map the length of the edges to themselves. Of course, the length, they don't change under the Pachner moves. And then we update the momenta according to what I just told you, where this action contribution here is just the contribution coming from the new syntax list.
So most of the time, the second term in the update rule is going to be zero, because the action for a Pachner move localized here is not going to depend on the edge length somewhere over here. So that term will only come in, the momentum will only be changed.
Yeah, only locally, yes. I mean, only of those edges that are involved in the Pachner move, yes. But I mean, you can define it on the whole hypersurface.
That's kind of true. I mean, outside the region where the Pachner move happens, nothing changes.
Yeah, yeah.
The position of the momentum changes.
Yeah, nothing changes. So and then now the problem C was the one that we have changing phase space dimensions. And the way we can deal with that is by form of phase space extension. So recall that once we have a given evolution step, that all those variables that have already gone into the past, they come with a vanishing momentum, so which is a constraint, which is just the equation of motion. And the same for all those variables that are only occur to the future of a given step. So that's why we can actually formally add those canonical pairs associated to those variables to the phase space at step n, just noting that these pairs are actually constrained. They come with a vanishing momentum. So in that sense, it's actually at that stage a trivial phase space extension. But it's helpful in the sense that we can put the phase spaces before and after a move to equal dimension. And then on this extended phase space, we can just perform the momentum updating, as I just told you on the previous slide.
But yep. Since you need to know whatever happened, you know the future of your evolution.
Sorry?
To describe your evolution, you need to know the future of all your evolution.
No, not necessarily, because all these, whatever edges would occur in the future, I mean, at this stage, they would just come with a constraint, vanishing momentum. So it's a trivial phase space extension, and you could equally well just solve the constraint and the factor.
You don't necessarily know which phase space extension. I mean, unless you know the future, you don't know which is
the future. Yeah, but it's also at this stage not even necessary. We don't need to know what the full solution will be.
So I had this question during your talk rather than another question. The question is the same. The first one is the same as the last. That is, in order to phase-based extension is a word.
Yeah.
What it means is that if you want to know what the whole phase space is, whose degrees of freedom are going to be involved, you have to know in advance what sequence of Pachner moves you're going to construct the manifold.
Well, I mean, in order to know like a complete phase space associated to the full, say, four-dimensional triangulation, yeah, then you would need to know the the full, you need to know what the full triangulation is. But in order to know what the phase space at a given step n is, I don't need to know that. Because all these extra variables that do not occur in the given hypersurface, at that stage, they just come with constraints and they can be trivially solved.
Right, but it seems to me you're emphasizing, you're calling something trivial when it's profound. That is, this is a new kind of time evolution where the geometry and the dimension of the phase space changes from moment to moment depending on, quote, what popularly is made in. And if that's true classically, then quantum mechanically, the Hilbert space will evolve.
Yeah, sure.
You say, sure, but in quantum mechanics, there's no example of quantum mechanics of a well-studied system with the dimension that Hilbert space evolves.
I mean, up to this, I also think there was not really a well-defined system classically, so.
From what?
Fock space.
Because in Fock space, you know what the Fock space is for the whole quantum field theory before you know how many particles. In Fock space.
But for example, in the framework of topological theories, you have one different Hilbert space for different hypersurfaces, and the transition amplitude coming from the operator that maps from one hypersurface to another, and they may have different Hilbert spaces, which you have similar to. It sounds to me like it's very similar. You have to
well,
know
it's
the
whole there's no notion of time in topological field theory. Here there's a claim being made that, quote, the Hilbert space or the phase space evolves in time. It evolves in time according to a choice of, quote, Hochman modes, which do I take the point of view that the choice of Hochman modes is something which is physically real? That is, it matters?
Not all of these choices. I mean, you can get one and the same triangulation by different sequences of Pach numbers. So, I mean, these, of course, have to be identical in the end. I mean, you have to identify those solutions.
Well, there are some cases, but there are many cases in which they don't need to make one and exclude.
Yeah, I mean, from a given hypersurface, you can generate different triangulations, of course, by the Pach numbers. And generically, in four dimensions, they will probably not be equivalent.
So we're not used to saying the Hilbert space of the system now is this particular space. And the Hilbert space in 10 minutes could be a different list of different things, depending on something which we're not used to thinking as being physically meaningful. That's called the choice of moves which are made.
The choice of moves in the end, for example, four dimensions, in the end does matter, of course, because, I mean, as I said, you can get inequivalent solutions a priori from arising from the same data. So in that sense, that if it gives you a different geometry, well, then it is physically relevant.
Okay, but, which leads to another question, which is that even when you mount up by gauge invariance, there's no, the future is not determined by the present.
Yeah, but I mean, this is actually a problem of the regularization scheme that we're using. I mean,
but is this a regularization scheme or is this a proposal for a fundamental form of dynamics?
Well, I mean, at this stage, I mean, it is a formalism for discrete systems, which. I mean, classical discrete systems would generally probably understand as a regularization scheme. So that's why, if you look at it in the continuum, the situation may be well different. So, but I mean, the fact that really when we have a given set of initial data that we cannot predict from this alone that there are several future solutions that are compatible with that data. Well, that's something that happens also with other discrete systems. I mean, not all discrete systems are hyperbolic.
Is that a question of the dynamics or of the fact that the same, I mean, if you are viewing it as a regularization scheme, that the same hyperservice could have somehow hyperbolic?
Sorry, I didn't quite understand your question. So
is that inequivalence generated really by the dynamics, if you want to view it as a regularization scheme, or the fact that you take the same continuum hypersurface and triangulate it in different ways, and those evolutions would lead to different solutions?
So basically, your question is whether, if you take the continuum limit, whether these different solutions may be equivalent? Is that one of the questions?
I guess I was turning it the other way around. If you are applying, if there are inequivalent solutions, being generated by different choices of moves in the dynamics, is that really fundamentally coming from the dynamics or coming from the fact that
the
same continuum hypersurface might have different triangulations?
This is really an effect of the discretization here. I mean, of the regularization scheme, because the discretization breaks the symmetries of the continuum. So in the continuum, when we have a given hypersurface and we evolve, you can get different evolutions, but they will all be related by symmetry transformations. And here in four dimensions, in the Raja calculus, that will not be possible because the symmetries are broken, and then different solutions may not be related by symmetries. So, but that's a result of the discretization.
I guess I was asking whether that occurs at the level of the triangulation of the hypersurface or in the dynamic, in the evolution.
No, in the evolution, then. Yeah, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, it's true that there's some kind of loss of predictability.
I mean, this even happens in...
It's a big jump from...
Yeah, actually, I was
right. It's enough to make one believe that nature is really continuous.
Sorry?
It's enough to, these issues are enough to make one believe that nature really is continuous. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, actually, time is running away and I'm... Okay, basically when we now extend the phase space, so if we have variables, for example, that only occur at step n plus 1 but not at step n, what we would then do is we just extend the phase space at step n by the corresponding canonical pair. And what happens is then you look at the momenta, they vanish before it actually becomes relevant because the action at that stage doesn't depend on that variable yet. And then after the at step n plus 1, the momenta are just given by momentum updating, where this part is, of course, 0 because of this here. And then afterwards, it's just given by that contribution here, which is compatible with the general definition of the momenta. So now let me give you a tentative phase-based picture for Raja calculus. In fact, there should be three types of phase spaces here. The first one, what I call the super phase space or covariant phase space, which would contain the information about all Raja triangulations, all Raja solutions. Then there is the total phase space, or the totally extended phase space, which basically is just a cotangent bundle of the total configuration manifold of some fixed four-dimensional triangulation, say. And then there is the phase space at step n, which is just the cotangent bundle of the configuration manifold at of the hypersurface at step n. So now the question is, how are these phase spaces related? So how the super phase space and the total phase space is related, that's something that I'm still trying to understand at a formal level. That's not totally clear to me yet, because there we actually have to understand how different solutions can be identified. For example, the issue of trivial subdivisions plays a role here. But this is also, at this stage, not really relevant. But what is relevant then is the relation between this total phase space and the phase space at step n. And basically, they are related by a partial reduction procedure, as I mentioned before. So what we basically do is we can solve all those constraints where we have vanishing momenta. These are a subset of first-class constraints. We can solve these constraints and factor out their flows, and what we end up with is the phase space at step n, which is the corresponds to the hypersurface at step n. Okay, and actually the super phase space here is kind of in spirit similar to a phase space for loop gravity, which also should contain the information about all graphs. Okay. Now, let me tell you something about the time evolution. Again, here, generally, we understand time evolution, at least canonically, as a canonical transformation. Now, here it happens that when we have constraints, the pre and post constraints, then the pre and post momenta are not all independent, of course. And then it turns out that, in fact, the time evolution defined by these pre and post momenta is only defined on and between the pre and post constraint surfaces. And then one can actually show that the symplectic structure restricted to these constraint surfaces, so basically the presymplectic structure on these constraint surfaces is preserved by this evolution map given by the pre and post momenta, and it's also preserved by momentum updating.
Can you? I don't really understand that when you change dimension.
So it's preserved on the extended phase space. So you have phase spaces.
Can you give an example for the one thing?
confuse how something that she mentioned.
Yeah, so I mean, basically, so what we would do is, I mean, that we, for example, say we have a variable which only occurs at step n plus 1, but not at n. What we then do is we extend the phase space by the canonical pair also at step n. So the phase spaces are of equal dimension before and after the move. And then we have post and pre-constraint surfaces in this in these two phase spaces. Then basically we can just use an embedding map of the post constraint surface or pre-constraint surface into our phase space, extended phase space at whatever step we're looking at. So what this here basically means, the result, is that if you look at the syntactic structure under the embedding maps, so pulled back to the constraint surface, say at step n, so basically this is what it means. So this result holds, so that.
Actually, so give me an example. So let's say I have only one variable. So p equals 0 before. So let's say suppose initial state have 0 variable, and next step have only one variable. So
you want to see it in coordinates now, or
zero,
you want to see it in coordinates now? You mean? Or?
Yeah, yeah. So initially, my first structure is 0, and
yeah.
After it's p.
Okay, so I mean, let's say that at step 1, so we have. 1 and say 0.
This is just one variable.
Yeah, so let's say here the omega 1 say is given by dx which dp. And so at the earlier step, well, p is supposed to be 0. Actually, I should put some labels on it. P 0. So what we do is basically we go from p 0 equals 0 to p 1 equals whatever the action is. So if we impose now, sorry. So actually, it turns out that what I should say here is that this here will also be constrained.
This what?
This, in fact, will also be a constraint here. So this is a constraint, but this is also a constraint. So when
you use constraint for equations of motion.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between constraints and motion?
Well,
there is a difference.
Yeah, I mean, a priori, you can in fact understand all these constraints. If you impose momentum matching, you can always understand them as equations of motion, in fact. So because the constraints that we get, they always read something like p equals ds. Dx, say, at some step n, say this is a post momentum. And if this is a constraint, then we could, by momentum matching, interpret this. So we will have then pn plus equals pn minus.
Mm-hmm.
This would be defined by the future piece of, say, of the triangulation, which would be given by minus ds n plus 1, say, dx n, say. Then if we impose this condition in here, really, then what we get is really the equation of motion, basically. So we get dsn, dxn plus dsn plus 1, dxn equals 0, which would be the equation of motion for that for this variable. But this only holds after momentum matching. So the momentum matching can, in this sense, be interpreted as a secondary constraint. But we will always work with matched momentum.
I'm trying to understand this, what
you're saying is clear, but there's one thing that I don't understand,
yeah.
Which is how the value of x1 gets set. This s1 is a function also of x1. And is there also an update rule I understand how the momentum gets.
Okay, yeah, so I mean, that's one thing that when we extend the phase space, for example, here in this case, when we get a new variable, and the phase space gets larger, what happens is, of course, when we have n variables at step n, and n plus 1 variables at step n plus 1, then we won't be able to determine what the length of the new variable is. So there's also in the Pachner moves, it then happens, for example, that the new lengths that we introduce are a priori free. There's no equation of motion that determines that. A priori, yes. So I mean, for example, here in this case, in the 1-3 Pachner move, so we get three new edges. But in this 1-3 Pachner move, there's no equations of motion that have to be satisfied at that stage. And so there's no way of determining what the length of the new edges are. So a priori, they are free data. But they can get fixed by other Pachner moves. But this is something that I want to
That happened in the future.
I will discuss that in a minute. So I mean, if I still have time. So because at this stage, actually, these three new edges, they're not internal. They're not involved in any equations of motion. All the equations of motion of the previous triangulation are completely unaffected by this move. So at that stage, they really can interpret that at some trivial boundary data that you have added. It doesn't really change your dynamics at that stage. So when you perform other moves later on that can change this, that's actually only at the stage where these new variables will become relevant in equations of motion. But this is something that I actually wanted to discuss a bit later in the talk. But
so if you regard this as a regularization, then these are more free choices in the regularization.
Yeah. I mean, this is just a basic consequence of the fact that here we're really considering the possibility that once we have a given hypersurface, we allow for the full freedom in the evolution. So I mean, we allow for changing dimensions, changing sizes of the triangulated hypersurface, and we also allow for full freedom of choosing different sequences of the Pachner moves. And so, if you now allow for the full freedom, and we don't restrict to spatial triangulations as in the tent moves, which are preserved in the evolution, then this new freedom that you get is just, I mean, that's what you get. So that's something that we have to accept and to deal with. But it is consistent. I mean.
But as long as they are not fixed, all choices are equivalent.
Yeah, I mean, actually. Yeah, I mean, actually, at this stage, what I really should say is that once we introduce these new, new variables, after that step, the momenta of them are actually constrained. So they are, I mean, in that sense, everything is first class. These constraints at that step, and you could still solve them. And so, the dimension of the physical. Phase space, you could say at that step is not really increased. But okay, I'm not sure how much time I have left. Because I still have a few slides, but I can try that. So one thing that I wanted to mention here is really that, I mean, just as in the continuum, we get now arbitrariness in the evolution when we have constraints. So now if the pre and post constraints are not all independent, then if we apply the implicit function theorem to this, then it will tell us, for example, that we are not able anymore to solve for xn uniquely as a function of the data at step n minus 1. So we can only uniquely fix such a solution by determining some a priori free parameters. So in the Lagrange calculus, for example, in the Pachner move, some of the new lengths.
In which case?
Sorry?
When
we have the constraints here, right? I mean, in general, when there's pre-constraints and not all of these pre-momenta are independent.
Constraints in pre and
Yeah, the pre, yeah, in both cases. Then we're not able to, then
would
we don't.
You have differences of order?
Sorry? No, just in general. I mean, when you have these constraints, then not all momenta are independent. And then you would imply the implicit function theorem to this, then you would see that you can't invert uniquely for xn as a function of the data as the n minus 1. I mean, it's just like in the continuum, basically.
Yeah,
Sorry?
Which condition? I mean,
so well, let's say we have...
It doesn't happen all the time. So when is it happening?
Well, when we have, for example, in this case, when we have pre-constraints, so when not all of these pre-momenta are independent. No, not necessarily. I mean, we can have systems where, for example, the phase space, for example, where you have preserved spatial triangulations or even some other systems, they may not have any constraints at all. So this is only when you really have constraints. So then these three parameters, lambda, well, they give us some arbitrariness in the evolution a priori, but they can get fixed also by equations of motion just as in the continuum as well. So in this, as I just discussed, the Pachner moves, for example, the new edges that you generate in some of these moves, a priori, they are free data. So okay, now you can apply all of this now to the Pachner moves in detail. I'm not gonna explain all this, but let me just summarize the Pachner moves for the evolution in four dimensions. And there's four of the moves. There's first of all the so-called 1-4 Pachner move. It introduces four new edges. In fact, this move again doesn't involve any equations of motion, so we can again not determine what the length of the new edges is. We can freely choose them. And it turns out that the momenta of the new edges are constrained by these kind of post constraints, which are constraints on the data at step n plus one, so on the data after the move. So, and then there's the so-called 2-3 move, which is similar here. It actually generates a new edge, which is this one here. Again, there's no equation of motion involved in this move, so again,
I'm confused about the first statement. So, you introduce four new edges, you say there's no constraint on them, and then you say there's a constraint.
No. I mean, there's no way of determining these new lengths by equations of motion. So, the length can a priori be freely chosen. But the momenta, once you choose the new length, then the momenta are determined. So the momenta are constrained in that sense.
The momenta are constrained.
So I mean, once you have determined the four new lengths.
This is your model of evolution. It seems to happen in the past because
of. I mean, it's just a consequence of the definition of the momenta, which is basically given by this here. So once you know all the lengths of the simplex, well, then you know what the momentum is. So, and that's why.
Yeah, I just like to remember your rules that for every new edge that I impose, I impose this constraint. So, when do I impose that P is DS over DS? What is your rule?
Well, I mean, that's the general definition of it. Yeah. But in fact, it's, for example, there's in three dimensions a 2-2 move. In that case, it actually turns out that this, when you do. The momenta this way, they are not constraints, but that's a special move in three dimensions. But in four dimensions, it's such that the new edges always come with these post constraints. So okay, but now in the 2-3 move, again, we can choose freely the new length of the edge. And that's actually relevant here because this move also renders this triangle here internal. And now recall that in the Lagier calculus, internal triangles actually carry the curvature. So in the deficit angle that describes the curvature here, in fact, depends on the new length. And so actually in this move, we can therefore, because the length is a priori free, we can also introduce an a priori free curvature at this stage. And again, this new edge comes with a post constraint. So these are the only two moves in four dimensions that generate new edges. They don't involve any equations of motion. And so that's why a priori, we can actually introduce all the lengths can that we introduce newly can be freely chosen, but only a priori. So, yeah.
Just the one you didn't mention, your attitude on the 4-1 rule is that you just erase the edges and their momenta that are erased. There's no constraints.
The 4-1 move is actually what I wanted to discuss now. So yeah, that's the inverse of the 1-4 move. It removes four edges from the spatial triangulation. And in fact, I mean, one can make this more rigorous, but I mean, basically because it's the inverse move of the 1-4 move, it doesn't come with four post constraints, but now with four pre-constraints, which are conditions that have to be satisfied at step n, so before the move. And these are really non-trivial conditions on the data at step n. They are in fact equivalent to the equations of motion of the four edges that become internal in this move. And if these pre-constraints cannot be satisfied by the data that we already have, then this move is just not allowed.
But generically, it won't be allowed. Won't be satisfied.
Well, generically, I mean, it can happen that a priori you cannot satisfy these moves, the constraints of these moves. That's true. But actually, I wanted to discuss that on another slide, but so yeah, so there's also the 3-2 move, which inverts the 2-3 move, and it also comes with a pre-constraint. So these are all the four evolution moves that we have in four dimensions. So
but Philip, that means generically, you're never going to be able to make either the 4-1 move or the 3-2 move.
Yeah, not quite. I mean, so I mean, you can construct many examples where you can do them. So I mean, I've looked at that also.
The thing is that you have many dimensions in hand, then you have four conditions to be satisfied. So it's a measure zero set in which you can. So it's not generic. By construction.
Well, but these are just, I mean, these constraints are just what you get. I mean, this is, I mean, there's no. But it's not actually a failure of this formalism. It's just, I mean, if you want to solve the equations of motion, this is what you get. So, but now to come back to your question, so I mean, now the pre and post constraints are actually, as I said in the beginning, the constraints, they have to ensure that we get the correct dynamics. So, and that's what the pre and post constraints basically do, because they restrict us the time evolution and the connectivity of the triangulation, because they both have to be satisfied at each of the steps. And so now let's assume that at a given step, n, for example, we want to perform a 4-1 move or a 3-2 move. And now we find that the pre-constraints of these moves are in conflict with the data that we have up to that step. Then we basically have two options. One is we just accept that we cannot glue that piece of triangulation to the hypersurface. And we have to perform some other move. For example, the 1-4 and the 2-3 Pachner moves, it turns out, are always possible. Or the other option is that we just change some of the previous data that we have introduced before in order to make this pre-constraint satisfied and in order to make this this move possible. So in option one is what we would do if we consider an initial value problem. So we just don't want to change the data at intermediate steps. And option two is probably what we would consider if we consider a combined initial and final value problem. So in that sense, it's actually not even very different from canonical GR. So, yeah, in fact, I mean, we need both the pre and post constraints to classify the degrees of freedom. In order to do that, we will also need to know whether they're actually first or second class. So to that end, note that a priori, the pre constraints among themselves and the post constraints among themselves form an abelian Poisson algebra. But generally, they do not commute with each other. And so this is, of course, important in order to know what the degrees of freedom are. So in fact, generically, so if we have now the post-constraint surface, which is the image of the post Legendre transformation into the phase space at step n, and the pre-constraint surface, which is the image of the pre-Legendre transformation into that phase space, and they are not equivalent, then we have to live on the intersection. Basically, it means the pre-constraints are independent of these, some of the post-constraints. That means they will actually fix some of the flows of the post-constraints, and thereby also some of the free parameters that are associated to the post-constraints. So, and in fact, then for the Pachner moves, it means that the pre-constraints of the 3-2 and 4-1 moves can fix some of the free data that we get from the 1-4 and the 2-3 moves. Okay. But at the end of the day, if we're left with some parameters that do not get fixed at all, then these really represent genuine gauge transformations. So yeah, I mean, I can discuss here how the gauge symmetries arise, but I'm not sure if I may skip this then. So basically, I mean, very roughly, how the gauge symmetries arise here is basically if you have if pre and post constraints match. What one should note is that the pre and post constraints, they're associated to, in fact, to left and right null vectors of the Lagrangian 2 form. Basically, they are given by the contractions of the pre-momentum and post-momentum equations with the left and right null vectors. Now, it turns out if you have a null vector matching, so some null vector is also a right null vector, and on top of it, it is also a null vector of the Hessian of the action, then it turns out that these pre and post constraints are first class. They generate really genuine gauge transformations, where really the the null vectors of the Hessian define the flat directions at the extrema of the action. So I mean, one can also do this for a Legendre calculus. This then gives the vertex displacement gauge symmetry. Maybe let me skip that. Well, one last thing that I wanted to mention is actually that it is actually important to note that here the numbers of constraints depend on the initial and the final slice. So once we have a fixed slice A and B, then the numbers of constraints on these two slices will be the same. But if we evolve further, then it can happen that, for example, now at slice C and A, we will now have more constraints than we had at B and A before. So this is, of course, important for determining what the physical degrees of freedom are in such a system. So because we need to know, of course, the total number of constraints. And here is where what I call a minimal slice becomes important. That's the slice, basically, or step which has a minimal number of variables and the largest number of constraints. And since constraints from a given step are propagated to all the other steps by the evolution, in that sense, actually, this minimal slice fixes the total number of constraints on this total phase space at all of the steps. This minimal slice may not be unique. It may also be difficult to know once we actually have a minimal slice. I mean, for some situation, it is clear. For others, it is not. And so in that sense, really, we need to know once we have such a minimal slice in order to determine what the observable degrees of freedom are. And so in that sense, the identification of observables becomes really non-local in discrete time. So, but for example, for the 10 moves, it turns out that every slice is a minimal slice. So in that case, we circumvent this problem. Okay, let me then just conclude. I've introduced here a general canonical framework which can for discrete systems which can cope with varying phase-based dimensions and constraints. It is equivalent to the covariant formalism. We solve the equations of motion at every step, so we get the dynamics. One can in particular apply this to simplicial gravity. We can in that way implement whatever evolution scheme you like, Pachner moves or Tent moves or anything else. And now, because we allow for the full freedom in the evolution, we encounter some peculiarities, for example, that the determination of what the physical degrees of freedom are kind of depends on this minimal slice, which we first of all need to identify. There are still some open questions that need to be fully addressed in this framework. First of all, I'm currently working on finalizing a complete constraint classification such that we can identify fully gauged and physical degrees of freedom, so that we can also answer the question of, for example, whether the reduced phase space dimension is actually preserved, even if the kind of kinematical phase space dimension varies. And then, also the covariant phase space should be understood a bit better. Now, in the quantum theory, so in the classical theory, you now have an equivalence between the covariant formalism and the canonic formalism, but this also should hold in the quantum theory. The heuristic idea for this is basically that we get the wave function. Once we have a wave function at step n, that we obtain the new wave function at step n plus 1 by basically just multiplying the old wave function with the exponential of the action contribution of whatever region we glue to it. And then with some suitable measure, we integrate out any bulk variables. And if we do that many steps in a row, eventually this should kind of go into the path in the row of Legendre calculus. So this is very heuristic what I'm saying here. It would be nice, of course, to make this a little more precise. In particular, then what we have to do with this, also what you mentioned, that we have to now implement evolving Hilbert spaces, which change in discrete time. And the question is then also if the time evolution is unitary or not. So these are some things that one should address still. And then, at least in the Legendre sector, it would be nice then also to connect to some recent developments on linking covariant and canonical quantizations, also, for example, in three dimensions, to link to the work by Valentin and Leopold. Okay, I think I will stop here then now. Thanks for your attention.
there may be a way to present that which is way simpler and faster. Because really, what you have is that, let's say, you have a minimal slice and a maximal slice. So the maximal slice determines somehow what big face space you're going to use to make your revolution. And then the minimal slice determines the rank of your syntactic structure, so that you have, you know, the possibility of planning the revolution. So, you know, you could always go from one slice to another by maybe going bigger slice. So that maybe one thing to do to restrict. Because in that context, you just need to know two types of the minimum size and maximum size. Another problem is suppose I have two, minimum slice and I have an evolution, and I take another one. At some point, maybe by getting bigger and bigger, I don't change the evolution, and therefore I stabilize. And that justifies the, maybe the discrepancy. Or maybe it always changes.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that one still has to address. I mean, this is one thing that I'm still working on to fully understand this, also the role of the minimal slice. But yeah, I mean, this is something that you just have to face when you are dealing with a general situation where you're allowing for an evolving lattice. But for example, yeah, like I said, when you restrict it to 10 moves, then every slice is a minimal slice, and then this problem doesn't even arise, and then the reduced phase-based dimension is also preserved in that setting. So, I mean, this is just the consequence of really considering a very generic situation. But yeah, I mean, it's quite clear that there's still many things that one can still look at and understand better. But still, I mean, the framework as it stands, I mean, it's consistent and will allow us to consider some of these questions now. And, beyond the heuristic level, just in this framework.
Maybe something else, which maybe a bit of a criticism, but we already discussed that. The fact that, I mean, by going to the discrete, since you introduce this huge, arbitrariness, which is the choice of this discrete action.
Yeah.
So, and then you have all these problems that arise, the constraints are varying, etc. So, what would be nice is, and so it's very nice to have all this formalism. The way would be nice is to have a way to improve this action. So I start from one, and I can evaluate, and maybe somebody else starts from another one, and then we can compare and say, okay, well, this one is an improvement compared to the other one. That is the level of trouble. So it would be nice to have a kind of measure of some kind of measure of how far we are from. You see, some kind of measure of how good the evolution is or not.
In this framework, you can think of this lack of taking the continuum limit, because you can start with a very coarse calculation, implement it like that refines.
Yeah, but maybe, but the thing is that if I change the action, am I getting better or not? You see, that's what I'm talking about.
So
I think an evolution of how
in improving the action comes with some kind of cost rating process.
Yeah.
Maybe not necessarily.
It's not
necessarily. What it's only in Yamini theory is not by cost grading, it's a different procedure. So what you need first is an evaluation of how good your action is. And it might be that cost grading improve, or sometimes it diverges first. So ultimately the limit, yes. Here you're proposing one strategy to improve the action, but at least a measure of what would be a measure that the action needs to be. Allowed to compare it by
action. Roughly, it's probably how symmetric the action is.
What?
I mean, roughly, it's probably how symmetric the action is. Of course, to quantify that is more complicated. No, I mean, for example, in discrete gravity, I mean, whether you still have diffeomorphism symmetry or.
Yeah, if you have more constraints, then that's an improvement, but for two actions that always break the symmetry, because it seems to be the case.
Sure, but this formalism here, I mean, it holds for any actions that are additive. So, I mean, if one improves it, then it will also hold for that. Yeah.
So, in fact, while we're talking about actions and parking moves, is there a particular action associated with parking moves that you know gives evolution consistent with Reggie factors?
In the regex action, but or you mean some other action that would be equivalent?
No,
to
no,
that
no.
Equivalent?
It was a dumb question. So you can implement all this with the regex action.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean,
the regex action. The you were talking about the Hamilton principle function, which is a function of the x's of regex and the p's that you add.
The Hamilton's principle function is not a function of the p's, just of the x's.
Right, so if I start with Reggie's action, which is a function of the x and not a function of the p's, the actions that...
Sorry?
No, I think I'm asking another dumb question again. So let me mark it up. You can implement everything you're talking about with the Reggie action.
Yeah, but I mean, I can implement that. That's what I tried to highlight with any action that's additive. So I mean, it's motivated by regex calculus in the end, but any discrete system that you come up with where the action is additive in the sense that you glue two regions together.
Okay, but in the case of regex calculus,
yeah.
To go back to, you were saying sometimes the pre-constraints just happen to be satisfied even though you wouldn't expect them to be. Do you know what the situation is in the regex calculus?
Whether the pre-constraints are generically satisfied or not? That's a very difficult question, but I mean, you can look at it in certain examples, and then, for example, tent moves you can reproduce by Pachner moves, and then you will see, well, generically, yeah, they will not be satisfied. But then what you can do is, because, I mean, there may be conflict with some of the data that you have introduced by previous 1-4 and 2-3 moves, which is still kind of boundary data at that step and hasn't really become physical. So what you can do is, and it's data at that same step, so it's not in the past, you can change the length of these edges in the same hypersurface accordingly to make the pre-constraint satisfied. So that's actually possible. So in that sense,
generic.
Generically, I haven't looked at a totally generic situation, but I would believe that generically you could do it. But you will have to change probably some of the data, the free data that you have introduced before, but from the same step.
Sorry for the dumb question.
No. Thanks for your interest.
I suggest we have some right now.